Tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome back. I don't even know how many times she's spoken here in this space, but we're delighted to have Laura Duggan return. I'm going to point out her book that we have, Carrie, here in the store, An Inquiring Life, Weekly Contemplations. But Laura's not here to talk about the book, this book, this time. She has, as most of you probably know already, an interest in the American philosophers Thoreau and Emerson and their influences in an arena where she has considerable expertise as the former director of the Muktabodha Institute for the translation of sacred Indian texts into English. And we are very pleased to have her here to tell us about her research in this area tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think I have to start with true confessions, actually, because my interest in the work of the transcendentalists, Thoreau and Emerson, although I've enjoyed reading and have just happened to have reread Walden a few months ago, but my interest in them was not completely self-born. I'm in a teacher training program in the Waldorf teacher training program, and I'm going to be doing a practicum with the senior students who are studying the transcendentalists. And one of the days that I've been asked to teach is the day that covers the Hindu and Buddhist influence on them. So I knew I had the Hindu and Buddhist part, and I did a little bit of research to catch up with the rest of it. So you're my trial audience. Make believe you're all seniors in high school. You've only got 4 more months before you graduate. You're kind of making it through the classes, and yet another
I'll hand out the rubber bands.
Right? So that's actually the origin of this talk, because I'm delighted to present it to you and then to them. And I thought we'd start with a little journey together. You can do it with your eyes open or your eyes closed. It's up to you. But imagine that you're someone who knows from inside that there's just much more to you than you can ever express. You know it to be true, but no one around you seems to understand who you really are. You know that inside there's a greatness. There's no limit to your mind or intuition. And when you go out into nature, you feel like you're one with whatever you see. But who can you share it with? All around you, nothing reflects this inner wisdom. You want to shout and say, "Look, something great lives inside me, something immortal." But when you go to the churches, you hear the preachers, and they're talking about rational mind. It's the year 1830. You're in your 20s, but you're in a world of your own. Can you imagine the frustration? What does it feel like that no one really knows who you are? And now you happen to pick up a book. You have to do a little translation work. Some of it's in German. You have to do some translation into English. And the book was written thousands of years before you were born. And through the veil of language and the veil of years, you read this. That one, seated in the heart, is the power that gives breath. That which is awake in us even while we sleep, that indeed is pure. That is Brahman, God, and that is immortal. That is the self, and tattvamasi, you are that. To those who see the self revealed in their own heart belongs eternal bliss. Take a minute and just think about how it might feel to hear these words for the first time and recognize your own inner experience. and you can open your eyes. In the 1800s, before we had internet and jet travel, before we had bloggers and iPods, in Massachusetts, Concord particularly, Emerson, followed by Thoreau, encountered the great teachings of the East. Both the Hindu and Buddhist texts became available to them. And their meeting with these texts was like a meeting with an old friend. They immediately recognized in what they read their own intuition, their own insight, their own discovery. This is what they had been feeling all along, and now it was confirmed from across ages. And the recognition ignited a fire in them. Thoreau wrote in his journal after reading one of the texts called the Dharma Shastras, which is no lightweight text, believe me. He said, "I cannot read a sentence in the book of the Hindus without being elevated. It has such a rhythm as the winds of the desert, such a tide as the Ganges, and seems as superior to criticism as the Himalaya mountains." And the very next day he wrote, "The very locusts and crickets of a summer day are but a later gloss on the Dharma Shastra of the Hindus. They are a continuation of the sacred code. The very locusts and crickets." As soon as I read that, I thought of a poem by the Zen master Dogen. He wrote, "The mystical cry of monkeys, resounding from the mountain peaks, echoing in the valleys below, the sound of the sutra being preached." When someone has a direct experience of what they read or what they hear, then the words are no longer words, and the philosophy is no longer just a bunch of concepts. In fact, it simply becomes what they see in the world around them. It becomes their living truth. And that's what happened with Emerson and Thoreau. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever heard someone speak or read something and immediately knew it reflected your own truth? What was it that Emerson and Thoreau recognized? Well, one of the first things they recognized in the text was, put very simply, what we are seeking outside ourselves exists within us, and it has always been there. Thoreau wrote, well, let me start with Emerson. Emerson wrote, "The highest revelation is that God is in every man." And he said, "It is one soul which animates all men." And he was so taken with this understanding, it was all he could speak about. So when he was invited to give a commencement address at a divinity school, they didn't know what they were asking for. Here was part of his speech. "In how many churches, by how many prophets, tell me, is man made aware that he is an infinite soul? That the earth and heavens are passing through his mind, that he is drinking forever the soul of God." Didn't go over very well with the established clergy of the time. Thoreau expressed the idea this way: "In the Hindu scripture, the idea of man is quite illimitable and sublime. There is nowhere a loftier conception of his destiny." And one of the great marks of the social revolution, and the transcendentalists were social revolutionaries. Don't mistake them simply for poets sitting there writing for the sake of writing. They were social revolutionaries. And one of the hallmarks of their social revolution was that they believed that this greatness was not limited to just a few. They felt it was the birthright of everyone. And they completely, for example, rejected the caste system of India even while accepting the philosophies. They were quite articulate. Here's a good example of how they thought in Thoreau's writing from Walden. And as I tell the story, imagine that you're a simple farmer. And this story is about you. John Farmer sat at his door one September evening after a hard day's work, his mind still running on his labor, more or less. Having bathed, he sat down to recollect his intellectual side. It was a rather cool evening, and some of his neighbors were apprehending a frost. He had not attended to the train of his thoughts long when he heard someone playing on a flute, and that sound harmonized with his mood. The notes of the flute came home to his ears out of a different sphere from that he worked in. They gently did away with the street, with the village, with the state in which he lived. And a voice said to him, "Why do you stay here and live this mean, moiling life when a glorious existence is possible for you?" All that he could think of was to practice some new austerity, to let his mind descend into his body and redeem it, and to treat himself with ever-increasing respect. Self-respect, recognizing the greatness in oneself and in others, is one of the basic tenets of Buddhism, of the Vedic philosophy, and also of the transcendentalists. The Buddha might call this innate nature Buddha nature. The Vedic texts refer to it as the self, with a capital S. And Emerson referred to that inner presence as the oversoul. The effects of this worldview, that greatness lives within me, that Buddha nature is my natural state, the effects of that worldview is, as you can imagine, a radical departure from the Puritan Christian concept of original sin. And it is nothing short of life-transforming. Because once we know and experience our own innate nature, it's hard to get permanently trapped by the ups and downs that life brings us. Rather, we do learn to become a witness. And the idea of a witness is actually fundamental to Buddhism and Hinduism, and it's yet another one of the threads that Thoreau and Emerson picked up and offered back to the Americans at that time. Here's how Thoreau describes it. "However intense my experience, I am conscious of a presence and criticism of a part of me, which, as it were, is not part of me, but spectator, sharing no experience, but taking note of it, and that is no more I than it is you." Thoreau brought a text called the Bhagavad Gita with him when he went to Walden for 2 years. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it expresses the idea of the witness as this: "The highest spirit in this body is called the witness, the consenter, the support, the experiencer, the great Lord, and also the supreme spirit." And another text that both Thoreau and Emerson studied was a collection of works called the Upanishads, which are the commentaries on the Vedic texts. Upanishad talks about the witness like this: "When a knower of Brahman has discriminated the real from the unreal," which means the transient from the eternal, "there remains only the subject, absolute and one without a second." But for Thoreau and Emerson, and for the Vedic teachers and the Buddhists, these are not just philosophical words. They are things that people experience for themselves. And it's something we can experience too. If you're willing, we can have a very short meditation to look at the witness that resides in us. Are you willing? You can close your eyes and just relax. And become aware of your body. Feel it sitting on the chair, your feet touching the ground. And as you scan your body, recognize that you are not the body. You can say to yourself, this is my body. I am not this body. I have a body. But who am I? Feelings and sensations can arise. And you can say to yourself, I am not these feelings and sensations. I have feelings and sensations. Who am I? And watch your thoughts. I am not my thoughts. I am having thoughts. Who am I? Whatever arises, simply note it and become aware of the one who is witnessing all of the experiences, sensations, and thoughts that flow through you. That meditation on who am I is a classic technique from the tradition, the Indian tradition called Vedanta, where you're asking yourself by the process of elimination, who is it that's seeing, and allows you to enter into that state of the witness. So you can take that home with you. In addition to recognizing the divinity in man and the presence of the witness, a third wisdom that is in Hinduism and Buddhism and also embraced by the transcendentalists, especially Thoreau and Emerson, is the idea of living in the present moment. The Buddhists might call this practice of being in the present moment mindfulness, where you're constantly aware of what's going on. And one Buddhist teaching about the practice of the present moment is usually in meditation instructions. For example, do not prolong the previous thought. Do not beckon the next or future thought. rest nakedly in the nature of fresh awareness of the present moment. But Thoreau and Emerson took the idea of the present moment and also applied it to daily life. They made it very practical, very accessible. In the essay called Self-Reliance, this is what Emerson writes. Man postpones or remembers. He does not live in the present, but with reverted eye laments the past, or, heedless of the riches that surround him, stands on tiptoe to foresee the future. He cannot be happy and strong until he too lives with nature in the present, above time. And in Walden Thoreau's writing, you can see he was constantly embracing the present moment as he observed nature, as he was interacting with the world around him. And he writes this: in eternity, there is indeed something true and sublime, but God himself culminates in the present moment and will never be more divine in the lapse of ages. We are enabled to apprehend what is sublime and noble only by the perpetual instilling and drenching of the reality which surrounds us. So the practice of being in the present moment is about keeping your senses open, being aware, watching where your mind is going. And it's a practice that is both for daily life and also for meditation. Since we're not going to go walking about in nature right this minute, we'll try it in meditation. Let's do another short meditation. You can close your eyes. And this time, allow your attention to be fully present. Whatever sounds arise in your hearing or sensations that arise in your body, give them full attention. See what's arising, but without judgment, without any discursive thought, without any analysis. Just be with what's present. See what is. Do not prolong the previous thought. Don't beckon the next or future thought. Rest nakedly in the nature of fresh awareness of the present moment. Present moment is all we have. Isn't anything else. So we've talked about the divinity within, and the witness and being in the present moment. There are many other themes, but one more that I'd like to touch on is the experience of nature, because this was a very significant part of Emerson and Thoreau's life, and it's also a big part of the Indian scriptures as well, the value of nature in the life of man. In the Vedic texts, nature is equated to divinity. There are just innumerable ways in which the expression of nature is the same as the expression of God, or the expression of God is the expression of nature. The Rig Veda, one of the earliest Vedic texts, explains it like this, or has one verse like this. O bright golden sun, when you are born, together with the dawn, you make the golden light shine forth where before there was no light. Indeed, from the unformed darkness, you reveal the beautiful form of this brightly colored world. Oh, bright golden sun. And it's interesting that it speaks about the sun, because Emerson makes an interesting point in his essay called Nature. He says, to speak truly, few adult persons can see nature. Most people do not see the sun. At least they have a very superficial seeing. The sun illuminates only the eye of man, but shines into the eye and the heart of the child. The lover of nature is he whose inward and outward senses are still adjusted to each other. In the presence of nature, a wild delight runs through man despite real sorrows. A wild delight. And Thoreau was very much a student of Emerson's. Emerson was his mentor in the beginning, and he echoes very similar sentiments. Thoreau writes, there can be no very black melancholy to him who lives in the midst of nature and has his senses still. I love that, because it is my experience that if you feel melancholy, go take a walk in the redwoods or go out by the beach. It's kind of hard to hold on to that melancholy for long. I do want to clarify that although both Thoreau and Walden write extensively about the power of nature, they were not hermits. They lived in town. Except for the 2 years at Walden, Thoreau was very much a townie. He grew up in Concord. He never left it. It was his place. He went to school. He had a few excursions, but not much. So they lived in a town. It was about a population of 2,000. And to them, nature was the place that they went to for their long walks, for their philosophical discussions. It was a respite for them. And that's not very different than we experience nature today. So it's not like you have to move to the woods to understand the power of nature. During my research, I discovered there's no end to the exploration of what Buddhism and Hinduism have to say and how it's reflected in the writings of Thoreau and Emerson. The number of subjects they covered, just to name a few, karma, reincarnation, Maya, contemplation, self-inquiry, all of these were written about by Thoreau and Emerson with great clarity in their own way. And in each of them we can find expressions of teachings from thousands of years ago. But what's also interesting is that Thoreau and Emerson echoed themes that were arising at the time they were alive in other parts of the world. For example, many people compare Thoreau's writing to that of the haiku poets and the Japanese hermit monks. Now, Thoreau didn't know them. He never read a single line of haiku. But the universal expression that Thoreau had was also touched in Japan and in Asia. So Thoreau and Emerson are reflections of the arising of a consciousness rather than a copying. There's a new book that just came out that I'm reading that's delightful. It's called Walden by Haiku. And the author has taken Walden literally and taken phrases from Thoreau and just rearranged the words in their order so they form haiku. And he has every chapter in haiku. It's quite very cleverly done. And he makes the point that the sensibility with which Thoreau saw nature and was in the present moment, he could capture haiku moments like that. So they didn't copy Eastern philosophies. They reflected Eastern philosophies in their own being. However, for me, one of the brilliant parts of this East meeting West is the model of being open and the model that it represents for us. How can we be open to hearing the truth, even if it comes across from other cultures, even if it's in languages that we don't know? How can we recognize the truth in what we hear from others? And most importantly, how do we go beyond sectarianism? Because that's what they did. A man once said to Emerson that he'd studied all the philosophies and all the religions, and he was convinced that Christianity was the only true one, to which Emerson replies, "That only shows how narrowly you read them." And Thoreau wrote of the Vedas, "In the great teaching of the Vedas, there is no touch of sectarianism. It is of all ages, climates, and nationalities, and is the royal road for the attainment of the great knowledge." So the sign of these great American thinkers was they held no prejudices. They didn't have a particular box they needed to fit things in, and they were not romantically enticed by the past. Instead, they just embraced what worked for them. For example, they took Buddhism and Hinduism and didn't get involved in its supposed oppositional points of view. Whatever was appropriate for them, they took, and they left the rest behind. They remind me of the Indian swan called Hamsa. Does anybody know what the Hamsa swan does? Somebody knows.
You mean the actual energy that's
emitted
to
them? No, I mean the swan.
The swan, which is Soham.
No, the swan's Hamsa. It's a swan who, when you give the swan milk and water mixed together, it can drink only the milk. That's a koan for you. That's a beautiful image. It can drink only the milk. It takes the purest of what it's given. And that's what Emerson and Thoreau remind me of. Whatever they read, they separated it out, and they took only the milk. They took only what would serve self-knowledge, what would serve the ability to think for oneself. Emerson said, "That is always best which gives me to myself. The sublime is excited in me by the great doctrine, obey thyself. That which shows God in me fortifies me. That which shows God outside of me makes me a wart and a wen." And I don't know what a wen is, but I don't want to be one. So I'd like to do now for a few minutes is use some of these passages as dharanas or focusing techniques. Because the reality is that the words of the Vedas, the words of the Buddha, and the words of Emerson and Thoreau have a power in them that transcends time. And its power is to waken something up in us. So if we can just let them flow through us, some will resonate more deeply than others. But just take them in as if you're hearing them for the first time. Maybe you are. What I'm going to do is read each of these passages. They're short and they're intermixed, so you're not going to know who said what. I can tell you later. But put your mind aside and close your eyes And when I'm finished with all, I'll pause in between. And when I'm finished, I'll ring the gong. Okay? To the illumined soul, the self is all. For him who sees oneness everywhere, how can there be delusion or grief? I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of universal being circulate through me. I am part or parcel of God. I am the lover of uncontained, immortal beauty. There is one mind common to all individual men. Every man is an inlet to the same. Of the universal mind, each individual is one more incarnation. The Absolute, though one, is conceived as many. Countless luminaries become one in him. He abides equally in the soul of all existing things. He is the inner self of all beings, seated in the heart of every living creature. The light which puts out our eyes is darkness to us. Only that day dawns to which we are awake. There is more day to dawn. The sun is but a morning star. Arise, awake, having attained your gifts, understand them. Sharp is the edge of a razor and hard to cross. Difficult is this path, say the sages. What has no sound, nor touch, nor form, nor decay, likewise is tasteless, eternal, odorless, without beginning or end. Beyond the great, stable, by discerning that, one is liberated from the mouth of death. The Transcendentalists were not just writers. They had a passion for changing the world they lived in. They felt that people had gone to sleep. Gone to sleep in America after the rousing Revolutionary War that was only 80 years earlier. Their writings were a cry to wake up. It is said that soon after the Buddha attained his enlightenment, he passed a man on the road who was struck by the Buddha's extraordinary radiance and peaceful presence. The man stopped and asked, "My friend, what are you? Are you a celestial being or a god?" "No," said the Buddha. "Well, then, are you some kind of magician or wizard?" Again, the Buddha answered, "No." "Are you a man?" "No." "Well, my friend, then, what are you?" The Buddha replied, "I am awake." This is the message that Emerson and Thoreau bring to us from the 1800s in America. Thoreau writes, "To be awake is to be alive. I have never yet met a man who was quite awake. How could I have looked him in the face?" My wish is that the example of these early American writers and thinkers, Thoreau and Emerson, and the great ones before them, and the ones yet to come, can help us all to wake up. May it be so. Thank you. Sure. I'm not sure I can answer them, but if you have any questions. Yes.
I understand that Thoreau and Emerson were also reading Hafiz and...
Yes, in fact, you know that Emerson translated something like 250 pages in his journal of Hafiz from the German. Yes, he read many of the Sufi mystics. It's quite incredible to think of.
Do you know when the Sufi mystics were in Western...
No, most of the stuff was in Europe, you know, and because Persia wasn't that far from the Europe area, they would have gotten to Europe pretty easily, actually easier than the Eastern guys would have. But I do know for sure that Emerson had access to German works and translated it all by hand.
It's interesting that you mentioned the other sacred text as well, that were translated from the German. We got all of these.
Lotus Sutra. Thoreau took the Lotus Sutra, I believe, was in German when he got it, and he had to translate it also from German. Because in Germany, well, to back up, the Transcendentalists were very influenced by the German intellectual movement. People like Goethe and Kant were major influence for the philosophy. So it's only natural that what they were reading there also came their way. And Emerson took a trip to Europe where he encountered a lot of that thinking and brought it back with him to America. Thoreau never left Concord, but Emerson did.
Nothing was happening in Britain at that time around the translations of Mid-Eastern philosophies and poets.
I don't think the UK and the Anglican Church were that into it. And in fact, if you think about it, that's what makes the Transcendentalists so revolutionary, because the established Christian churches were very strong in those countries.
In Concord at the time, how were they accepted socially and politically?
They were thought to be a bit weird at first, but Emerson was a very, what's the word when someone has charisma, very charismatic person, so he drew these people around them, and they had what was called the Transcendentalist Club, and they were not accepted by the mainline clergy, Unitarians. They were not accepted by them.
He had a teacher as well.
He had been a preacher, but he quit, and then he became a lay preacher preaching, and Thoreau was a teacher.
Do you know the relationship between the Transcendentalists and the Enlightenment thinkers that fed the founders?
No, I don't. I don't. But I do know in what I read, they call this sort of the second enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And then the next one happened after America went to sleep, and then the Beat Generation came in 1950. So there's a big gap between the mid-1800s and the next time that this resurgent happened. Yeah.
Is there a connection between Rudolf Steiner and his work? Hinduism.
Yes, there is. There is, in fact, that's why I'm doing this class at the high school, at Summerfield High School, because Steiner was very influenced and had a very strong connection to Goethe, for one thing. And one of the transcendentalists was Bronson Alcott, Louisa May Alcott's father, who had tremendously novel ideas about education, which very much parallel Steiner's ideas. And so the Waldorf schools like to teach the transcendentalists because they also emphasize the way they educated children. And Thoreau also attempted to do that. But Bronson Alcott was the major figure in education.
And Hinduism?
Hinduism and Steiner. Steiner was a theosophist originally, and they basically took Vedanta and then they westernized it. And then they kept some of the words and they threw out some of the other words, but the principles are basically Vedanta principles. And so when Steiner formed his own philosophy, it was grounded in Vedanta, but then he was a mystic, so then it went off into his own direction. But it has a lot of the principles you would find in the Hindu scriptures, almost identical, actually. Any questions? No, I highly recommend rereading, if you get a chance, Walden, because once you realize where he's coming from, it's quite fun to have a second take on it. And you can see that he mellows towards as he goes through the book. In the beginning, he's a bit intense, and as it goes on, he gets much more poetic and lightens up a bit. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers Books. That was delightful, wonderful, evocative, much appreciated.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming out tonight. I'll point out that we have both copies of Laura's book here on the counter. We have a donation bowl, and we share contents with our speakers and reserve half to help maintain the continuity of this space. So thank you for coming out tonight, and I hope to see you again at another event soon here in Many Rivers. Thanks.
Thank you.